focus.
Take over and.
We sit now or do we wait until they come up?
Get some water, right?
Yeah, so Aaron.
Probably, I'll get some.
Right.
I start hacking away and I start hacking like crazy.
Why don't you take closer to Chase?
You don't get a microphone? Unequal opportunity here.
I'm not even on the camera. Look at this.
Oh, you're not? No. How strange is that?
Sorry.
Okay.
That's just a one shot.
All right. So I should look at the camera, not him?
Him.
What?
Him.
Look at him. Okay.
Right. Hello. My name is Aaron Moser, and I am here on behalf of MMTV, our high school's television show broadcast live from CTSB TV studio in Lee every Sunday. I would like to start the evening by asking you a few questions. First, you are both a politician and a physician. How do you see the fields of politics and medicine as related, and how has the transition been working back and forth between fields?
They are related in the sense that both are, if it's done right, helping professions, although some would wonder about that with politicians. There are actually some interesting, for me, there have been some interesting personality traits, most of which have been helpful and some have not been helpful. The first is that because I have a scientific background, I have very little tolerance for arguments based solely on emotion. The facts matter a lot to me because you can't do anything without the facts. And if the facts are unpleasant, that's just too bad. You've got to deal with them. That's kind of what you have to deal with in medicine. The other thing is I like to make decisions. In medicine, you can't dawdle around and wait and wait and wait and postpone. You just get it done, then you move on to the next thing. And that's been helpful. On the not-so-helpful side, doctors tend to, after a while, think they know everything and the patient doesn't know anything, and that's a very bad trait to have in politics because everybody matters and everybody's vote counts. So you can't be impatient with people in politics, and sometimes being a doctor, you kind of tend in that direction. So I'd say there are two really good things about it and one not-so-good thing about it.
All right. Now, I've heard you talk about our healthcare system and say that when we fix it, we're going to have to fix it in three ways. Fix in the short term, in the medium term, and in the long term. Could you just talk a little bit about what each one of those looks like?
Well, the short term deals with the affordability of it and the accessibility of it. I mean, this is the only industrialized democracy in the world that has a substantial number of people with no health insurance. We also have a big economic problem. Our car companies can't compete, let alone with the Chinese, with the Canadians, because they have a huge overhead with health care, which the Canadian companies don't have to pay for. General Motors spends more on health care per car than they do on steel. And that puts us at a pretty big competitive disadvantage. So we've got to fix it for two reasons in the short run. The middle term is what I hope we're going to do in Congress, which is to make it affordable, accessible, and a reasonable system that works for everybody. The long term is the toughest. You have to change the mindset of Americans about healthcare. And this is not just the insurance companies and the doctors and the pharmaceutical companies' fault. This is our fault, the American people's fault. We've got to move towards what I call a wellness model instead of an illness model. A lot more prevention and stuff that we're responsible for, not just the healthcare system, eating properly, exercising, and so forth and so on. And we've also got to get over this idea that even though it's made our country great, that everything is ultimately conquerable, because we believe, one of the reasons our healthcare system is so expensive is that Americans believe we can beat anything, including death. And that's a very expensive enterprise.
Right. I've heard so much of the money, I've seen a large percentage of the money we spend in hospitals is spent with people who are right at the end of their lives,
right,
or who, it's very clear, are at the end. How can we save money and operate in a cost-effective manner while still treating people fairly and justly?
There's a great way to do it, and it's again, easier said than done. When I was first practicing, I'm an internist, which means I'm a kind of a family doctor for not pediatric patients. We saw people from about the age of 5 to 105. And it wouldn't be unusual for me to take care of a whole family. If a very much older person in the family gets very ill and you don't think that they have any chance, you can go to their family and say, look, I don't think we're going to get anywhere. We can put all these tubes in and do this or that, which obviously is very uncomfortable, but I don't think it's going to go anywhere. And the family, if you know them, 90% of the time is going to say, okay, let's get everybody around. We'll make this decision. We'll get back to you. And then you just don't do things. These days, if you go to an ICU, an intensive care unit, you're going to see a doctor that you've never seen before who's a specialist in intensive care. Well, no doctor who doesn't know you is going to tell you that your mother can't, you know, live much longer, and you're not going to want to hear it from him anyway. So the whole corporatization of medicine has made it impossible to continue the kind of informal decision-making that goes around the end of life. And it's incredibly hard to formalize that because you don't want some board deciding whether your parents are going to live another month or so. These are very, very personal decisions, and we've got to find a way to bring the doctor-patient relationship back to where those decisions can be made between people who trust each other.
Right. Okay. How can we enter into serious talks about reforming our healthcare system without sparking an ideological debate and a political debate, and without dealing with labels of socialism and socialized medicine?
Well, you can't. I mean, clearly the right wing is opposed to this. Because they are ideological. I think you have to appeal to the American people. And I like Barack Obama's healthcare plan, not because it's perfect, because there's no such thing as a perfect plan, because it should be easily explained to the American people, which is why we haven't been able to do this before. You have to understand, healthcare is like politics in another way. People don't like Congress, but they like their congressman. People don't like the healthcare system, but they love the care they get and they like their doctor. So if you say to them, we may have a system where we're going to assign your doctor, or you're not going to get as many choices as you have today, they're not going to like that. Obama's system basically says, if you like what you have, you can keep it. If you don't have insurance, you can sign up for a private plan. And if you don't want to sign up for a private plan, you can sign up for a public plan, which is like Medicare. Well, all those are known options. People understand private insurance, they understand employer-based insurance, and they understand Medicare. So there's no new threatening idea in Obama's plan. It just means we're going to change this around. If you don't have anything, you can make your choice about what you would like to have. The Republicans will object because the insurance companies give huge amounts of money to the Republican Party and some Democrats, and they don't want this system because they don't want you to have a public option because they don't make as much money. But that's Republicans and the insurance companies are about the only people who are really reasonably going to oppose this, which means it should pass. Doctors have been treated badly by insurance companies, so they're willing to do this public option now. Hospitals are willing to do it. Everybody knows that we've got to change, and I think now is a great time to do it. You only have one interest group instead of 10 interest groups, which fought us 15 years ago when we tried it.
Right. How serious is the threat of a Republican filibuster to block new legislation and prevent progress?
It's serious, and I think instead, here's what I hope, here's what I fear, and here's what I hope for. I hope this is going to pass, and there are some thoughtful, sensible Republicans who get what their constituents want. 73% of Americans think they ought to have a choice of a public option. So only ideology is the only justification for not doing it. What I hope will happen is it'll pass with some Republican support. There's two other things that could happen. The worst thing that could happen is it would pass because the Republicans threatened a filibuster and the Democrats gave up on the public option. Then you'd have nothing. You'd have a little insurance reform, but you wouldn't have any serious health care reform. The other thing that could happen is the Republicans could filibuster it. If they do it, I think that's great. It's not great. I'd rather have the bill. But what we don't want to pass is a lousy bill. If they want to filibuster the bill and kill health insurance reform, they'll be a smaller party than they are today, and we'll get it passed in 2011. I would prefer that Obama's plan passes. The worst option is that the Republicans filibuster and they get rid of the public option. If that happens, the bill's not worth passing, because we'll pass it again because we'll have the votes in 2011, because the American people will not permit the no party to vote no on something as important as that.
Okay. Today in the Arts and Ideas Forum, you spoke about how so much of the cost of healthcare comes from people having tests and procedures done that they don't need done and that are done to make profits for the hospitals or for the companies. How can we create a system where the individual or the patients have some sort of personal stake, where it's not just the insurance company paying this bill, so that people would actually be incentivized to use less.
That's one of the most difficult and sophisticated questions in healthcare, and nobody knows the answer. There are a lot of things that have been tried. Nothing has been terribly successful. My guess is we'll continue to try a few things and see what happens. Here are the possibilities. One, you share the cost. The problem with that is these expenses, these procedures are very, very expensive, and so it doesn't take much cost sharing to put you in a lot of financial trouble. Two, you have a global budget. That is, you tell the hospital and the doctors all together as one group, this is all you get for healthcare to take care of the 100,000 patients or whatever it is that you're responsible for. So if you want to do 59 tests on this patient when you could do 23, be my guest, but you're not going to have as much money for the other people. That'll be hard to do, because it's going to be very hard when if there's a terrible flu epidemic or something of that sort, and the budget is out of control for reasons beyond your control. What do you say? Too bad for you? So it's very, very complicated. It has to be done, and what you're going to have to do is put downward financial pressure on doctors and hospitals to perform what's necessary, but not to perform what else is necessary. There's something in this, in the stimulus package, called comparative effectiveness review. It's great. Of course, the right wing hates it. Rush Limbaugh doesn't like it, which probably means it's great for the country. And it means that you can look at procedures and see if they're any good or not, and compare them. It's very useful in drugs. There's three different kinds of drugs that do this. Let's find out which one really works and which ones are just more expensive but don't work any better. And then that helps people decide what the best treatment is. You can do the same thing with procedures. But it's very, very complicated, very difficult. Lots of things have been tried, and none of them have been, they have all been a little successful. None of them have been really successful.
Right. Do you believe in offering health care to illegal immigrants?
Well, that's a very hard question. I certainly believe in offering health care to the children of illegal immigrants, because they're likely to be here, and they're going to cost a whole lot more than when they're 40 than they are when they're 5 if you don't do the preventive maintenance. As a physician, I really was taught not to refuse treatment to anybody. So as a physician, I would say yes, but as a public policymaker, I would say no, other than the children. If you offer health care to undocumented people, the problem is you become a magnet for folks who have medical problems in other countries where they can't get coverage. So it's a very difficult human dilemma. And I probably, if I were putting together a bill, I would cover the children of people undocumented, but probably not them themselves. Now, the irony is they're going to get the care anyway. They're going to go to the emergency room, get worse care, and end up passing the cost along to the insurance companies, because the hospital has to make up that money somehow. So it's a very complicated idea. I'm just a little worried that if you offer it to a vast number of adults, we will start to attract people here by essentially giving free care.
Okay. Right now, we're in dire economic times, and you spoke briefly about how the economy and healthcare related, but could you just go a little bit more in depth,
sure,
about especially where we are now and how, if we want to fix this economy, the role healthcare could play in that?
Right. You asked me earlier about three stages of healthcare reform. Well, I'm going to talk about three stages of fixing the economy, because healthcare is a big piece of it. The short-term stage is fixing the toxic assets on the bank balance sheets and stimulating the economy and so forth and so on. And we're well on our way to doing that. The second phase is healthcare, which we're going to talk about in a minute. And the final phase is education. Because if we want a strong economy 20 years from now, the seeds for that are going to be built now by investing in small children between 0 and 3, so they can, when they get to the school system, they can profit and learn something. So now let's focus on healthcare. We are not competitive because our healthcare system is so different than all our competitors. For example, small business generates 80% of all the jobs in America. Small business really struggles to keep up with the healthcare costs. Many of them don't offer them, which means their employees can go there, and then when they get a better offer from a big company, they go, which makes it harder for small business. Obama's plan says if you have less than 45 employees, you have no obligation to do any health insurance. We'll just take over that responsibility, and the employee and we will buy health insurance in this system that they have. That's a big help to the job generators. The large companies are also incredibly disadvantaged in the international marketplace by the fact that they have to pay for something that's going up at 3 times the rate of inflation, has done so for 25 years. So if you, the solution, one of the big solutions you could, for our car companies, for example, is to take the retiree health benefits, which they're contractually obligated to pay for, and say, okay, the government will be responsible for these. That would be a huge benefit both for the retirees and for the auto companies, or the steel companies, or any of those other industries. So there are some things that you've got to fix if you want to make our economy strong. Again, if you don't fix it, we're not going to generate the kind of jobs we should, and we're not going to keep the kind of high-wage industrial jobs that we should.
Right. Today you spoke of what a large percentage of our gross national product we spend or is goes into healthcare. I believe you said 16%.
Yep.
If we were to switch plans, how much would we see that number come down, and how quickly would that happen?
Well, the first thing that you would look for is not to make it come down, it's just to stop it from going up anymore. I mean, it continues to rise at 2 or 3 times the rate of inflation. That's an enormous problem. It will ultimately come down only, not just with a kind of a rationalization of the process, because right now it's not a rational process. It will only come down if we also change the lifestyle of Americans and get people to take some responsibility for their own health care. And I don't mean just going to the doctor for a checkup once in a while. I mean, as we talked about before, eating properly and exercising properly and getting things taken care of before they get to be a big problem and not afterwards. And then with some economic restraints like global budgeting and things of that sort, that's how you could drive it down. But driving it down is going to be much, much more difficult than keeping it where it is. If we could do that alone, I think that would be a good thing.
Okay. Before today, you were calling to us, to the people of my generation, to stay involved with politics as we go on. Now, there have been rumors circulating with your name up for a possibility to become the new head of Health and Human Services or Surgeon General.
That one was disposed of a long time ago.
Or Surgeon General.
Right.
How do you feel about staying involved in politics? And if you were called to, would you?
Well, I'm not going to answer. I don't generally answer those kinds of questions, but I'll give you a broader general answer. There are lots of ways, as I said before, to be involved in politics. Right now, I work as an independent consultant for a political action committee, which I started when I left the presidential race, and we'll be focusing heavily on progressive causes, election reform, and healthcare reform. I work part-time as an independent consultant for a law firm on an alternative energy and healthcare in Washington. And I have a number of other interests, including spending time abroad working on democracy issues in other countries. So I'm hardly uninvolved in politics, but as I said earlier, there are lots of ways to be involved in politics, and you don't just have to have appointed or elected office to do it.
Right. All right. Right now, I'd like to say thank you, and I would like to open up questions to the audience. Please just state your name and affiliation before asking your question.
Hi, I'm Karen Schrifter. I'm a freelance writer, but the questions are going to be related to Berkshire County Senior Citizens newspaper, which I edit.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems seniors have been having is the donut hole.
Right.
And then the other thing is the chaos of choosing drug plans. From your inside knowledge, is there anything in the Obama's proposal or word on the street, whether any of that's going to be fixed?
Well, his plan calls for removing the subsidies from the private insurance companies. So some of them will get out of there, and that'll change the chaos, and it'll also presumably more people will sign up for the public plan. I believe that they want to close the donut hole, and the way to get the money is, in fact, to take away the 17% subsidy that we give to the private insurance companies for running that plan. It was a good thing they did a drug plan, but it was done by Republicans who somehow believe that giving money to private insurance companies is going to make the system more efficient. It doesn't. Private insurance companies are less efficient than Medicare. In most cases, the private sector is much more efficient than the public sector. That's not true in healthcare. So I do believe that'll simplify the system and make it much easier for them to understand what the alternatives are.
Hi, Governor Dean. Thank you for coming to Great Barrington. I'm Barbara Dean, a relation that I know of, from Station WBCR in Great Barrington. And I'd like to know if, in principle or personally, you would support John Conyers' bill, H.R. 676, which is calling for single-payer health system and lays out very good reasons and very good ways to accomplish that. And also, if you would agree that one of the main reasons for Congress not wanting this to happen is the incredible power that the lobbyists and the invested interests, the hospitals and the pharmaceuticals, have. They have sway over Congress people, and would finance reform, campaign finance reform, help that situation?
John Conyers and I are very good friends, and I think his bill is an important addition to the debate, but I think President Obama's bill is the right way to go, because in that way, if you want to, as a patient and an American citizen, if you want a single, want to be in a single payer, you can choose to be in one, but if you want to be in the private insurance system, you can choose that too. So I believe that Representative Conyers' bill would probably not be embraced by the American public. I do believe that President Obama's bill will be embraced by the American public, and I think that should that be the bill that comes to the floor of the House, that Representative Conyers will support it, because the idea of forcing everybody into a single payer, I think, will be resisted by the American people. Do special interests have something to do with this? Yes, sure they do. You will make more special interests mad by insisting that everybody be in a single payer than you will by simply insisting that they have a choice of a single payer. So there's no question that it's easier to pass President Obama's bill, but it's also probably, the reason it's easier to pass is because it's less vulnerable to the kind of scare tactics that went on 15 years ago when the Clintons tried to fix the healthcare system. So again, I have enormous respect for John Conyers. I think his bill is a very valuable addition to the debate, but I think the president's bill is the bill that's most likely to pass because it gives Americans more of a choice.
Trevor Jones over at Berkshire Eagle, so welcome to the operator. And I just want to get your take on how you view yourself in terms of being at the kind of first steps is with internet fundraising, and then looking back and the 50-state plan and helping Democrats kind of come back to power. How you think you view your role in that shift in the past 6 years, and how you think they're doing so far in the first 50 days?
I think the president's doing great in the first 50 days. Obviously, he's got to finish a lot of things that he started, but certainly he gets A-plus for starting the things that needed to be done. I think that the people who attack him for trying to do too much don't understand how interrelated all these things are. If you just fix one of these things, you're not going to be any better off than you were, because you're going to get back in the same problems we've had. We need to take a wide view of the things that have to be fixed. In terms of we did revolutionize campaigning, and more importantly, I think reach out to ordinary Americans to help them understand that they had the power in the political system if they only chose to use it. And I think, of course, the Obama campaign was incredibly disciplined and expanded dramatically the kinds of things that we discovered during our campaign. Obviously, I think their campaign was the most disciplined campaign I've ever seen a Democrat run in my lifetime in politics.
Governor Dean, thanks very much for coming to our high school. It's a great experience listening to you this afternoon. And my name is Tyler Gasick, and I co-host a local show on WBCR, the local community station, with Natalie Akers and Simon Bond, two other students that go to Monument High School. And it's sort of the show about the high school. And I wanted to ask you, in what ways, it's kind of a broad question, but what ways would socialized healthcare change the atmosphere? Besides just saving money and being more efficient, how would it contribute to sort of our greater being?
Well, I don't think we're going to have socialized healthcare. So it's hard for me to answer the question. I haven't given a lot of thought. I think what you're going to see if the president's bill passes, if the president's bill doesn't pass, or if it passes without the public entity and the public choice, you basically aren't going to see anything different than what we got today. And it's not going to work. If the president's bill passes the way it's designed, what you'll see is a larger proportion of Americans signed up with a government-run healthcare plan, which I think will work very well for them, but they'll have the choice of getting out of that program if they don't like it. So I don't envision that the individual American is going to see very much of a difference. There'll be more people covered. It'll be easier to understand because you'll have more people in a system that makes rational sense. But you'll have a hybrid system between those who like to be in the private sector and those who prefer to be in the public sector. And it'll be at the individual American's choice, not the government's choice. And that's the important part about the bill.
Andy Potter, also with WBCR, a lot of community members there. I understand that you were in Britain in the last few weeks talking mm-hmm. to the...
Last weekend
to the National Conference of the Liberal Democratic Party. And I was wondering if you could share some of the nuggets from your experience at the Democratic National Committee that you might have shared across the pond.
Sure. It's a very interesting election coming up in Britain, whenever the Prime Minister chooses to call. It'll be sometime before the end of 2010. And there's a lot of political ferment. We don't take sides with parties there. I try not to interfere in other people's elections. But I went over to give advice and give a speech at the request of an old friend of mine who happens to work for the Liberal Democrats. I don't get paid for that kind of stuff because I don't want to do that. I don't think that's an American political consultants going over there telling people what to do is an attractive way to portray the country. But it's a very interesting system. The Liberal Democrats are a reformer party. They have a new majority or leader who would be the prime minister if they were to get the majority, who's about 42 and very dynamic. And they are very much into community organizing. But, of course, Britain is not, the young people in Britain are not nearly as mobilized as they are here. And so the task is to get young people mobilized the way that they are here, and that's what they like me to go over and talk about.
Hi, Kip Lynch, freelance writer. I'm curious what role you think, especially in light of recently Senator Harkin's comments about complementary and alternative medicine, what role non-evidence-based medicine should play and how it should be funded? Kind of your views on that.
Well, I think all medicine ought to be evidence-based. But I think we also have to open our minds to the possibility of some things that don't seem to be evidence-based in a narrow way. We should open up some of the examinations and relook at a lot of that. I know Senator Harkin very well, and he really would like that kind of scientific examination. He's not trying to sell something to the American people that's hocus pocus, but he does want people to have a more open mind, but I can't imagine that we wouldn't require any treatment paid for by the American government to be evidence-based. Can we look at that in a different way? Can we expand our views of what testing we ought to do and what experiments we ought to run in order to make it evidence-based? I think it's a real question.
Betsy
Selkowitz,
I'm on the Dallas committee. As I remember, there are no mandates with Obama's plan.
Originally, they're talking about some now. Originally, they're not. I personally don't think mandates work, but there's a great debate in Washington about whether you must require everybody to participate in order to have the pool fairly represent the people who are going to use it, the same profile as the people who are actually going to end up using health care. I personally have a different view of what you might do with mandates. I think that the American people won't respond well to those. But there are those experts who believe that if you don't have it, it doesn't work right. So it's an open debate. I happen to be on the non-mandate side of the debate.
So you think enough will maybe sign up for the public part that have in the past gone to emergency rooms?
Well, I actually think the people who don't sign up are people under 30. I mean, if you told a 25-year-old or a 23-year-old with no health insurance that they had to come up with couple of $1,000 and the government would pay the rest for their health care, they would much rather make a down payment on Harley Davidson. So I just don't think it's effective with that age group, which happens to be one of the large, percentage-wise, probably the largest uninsured group, although much cheaper than the over 55 segment of the population, between 55 and 65, which is much more expensive. What I would do, and this is not going to happen in this plan, in this year, I think, and if they put in mandates, it's no terrible thing, and they're just going to find out that they might have to do something different down the road. What I would do is simply give health care coverage for free for everybody under 30. And the reason for that is it's incredibly cheap. We gave health care for a very low price for everybody under 18 in my state. 99% of all people under 18 in my state have eligibility for health care, and 96% have health care. So It seems to me with the younger population, they are so mobile and so unlikely to work for companies that give health insurance benefits, and so and change things so their status so often from being in school to being working for a small business to not working at all to starting their own business, and their risks are so much relatively so much lower in terms of what they end up costing the system that, you know, we didn't even have to raise taxes when we did this. I'll confess that since we use Medicaid as the expansion vehicle, the federal government paid about 60% of it. It's just a no. That's what I would do. Sometime, this is not going to be in this legislature, in this Congress. They'll probably do mandates or not. I don't think it makes much difference. There'll be some percentage that's not in the system, and if you want to get them in, it's so cheap for the under 30 that you just can, you could give it away. Potentially, for, you couldn't. I wouldn't do it for free, but you know, a low enough copayment so nobody would not do it. The over 55 to 65 is a much bigger problem. But those people know that there's a real risk. They're adults. They're not in that. Nothing is ever going to happen to me. Age group, and they will, I think, overwhelmingly buy health insurance without a mandate.
What in Massachusetts? What we have mandated?
You do have a mandate in Massachusetts. It's mandated for everybody.
Apropos the over 55 and under 65, why I'm asking that. Have you heard anything? I know he's the president said the goal is to have to be affordable. Have you heard any numbers thrown around?
There are some in his proposal. I don't remember what they are, so I shouldn't really comment. Anything I would say would be speculation. And they will change because in Washington there's something called scoring, which means both the Office of Management and Budget, but mostly this Congressional Budget Office, which is viewed as the most neutral scoring agency, will say what this proposal is going to cost. And I think everybody's going to be horrified by the cost, so there's going to be some wiggling around of how to adjust that cost, and one of them will be probably the amount that the individual has to put in to get health insurance.
This is totally off health care, but I'd love to have your knowledge. You headed the RNC during...
Please. Although the RNC could use a little help these days. I believe that job is Rush Limbaugh's now.
Sure. You headed the DNC, and I can't help but think it wasn't all Barack Obama, although obviously he had a tremendous effect why the Democrats are doing so well in terms of numbers. What was your job description? What kinds of things
did you do? Our job description was to rebuild a party that wasn't a national party anymore. If you're only competing in half the states, you're not a national party. If you have no technology base and no interaction with the states, you're not a national party. So the first thing we did was get ourselves in every single state and start supporting the state parties. 26 states had no press secretaries, so we hired 26 press secretaries. And then organizers in every single state. And the next thing we did is to build a modern technology base, which the Republicans had beat us by 15 years. So when I first got to the DNC, I looked around and I said, there's no way we're going to catch the Republicans before 2012. We hired a bunch of smart 25-year-olds who I think slept under their desk for 2 years, and we caught them by 2006. We now have this incredible technology, this incredible list, and this incredible ability to get the vote out by identifying people and going and knocking on their doors. We also totally changed the way we relate to voters. The internet's great, television and all that stuff. The fact of the matter is, the most important individual factor in getting somebody to vote for you is personal interaction with them. And that does not mean one door visit or dropping some literature on their porch. It means getting to know people. So we had this neighbor-to-neighbor program where the same person would knock on the same door four or five times during a period of time before the election, get to know them. And that really influenced their vote. And a lot of this stuff was based on Marshall Gantz, the Harvard community organizer, who was sort of a descendant of Saul Alinsky from the 60s, who wrote this incredible, has done this incredible body of work, which we used in our primary in New Hampshire. It's unbelievably effective. It's expensive because it's very labor intensive. But basically what you do is build affinity groups who are not just loyal to the candidate. They begin by being interested in the candidate, but they end up being much more loyal to themselves around issues like their kids and their neighborhood and their schools. It is almost impossible to pry people away from a candidate once they've formed that kind of an affinity group. And that's the long-term goal that you want to do when you're really organizing. It is really very, very labor intense, but it works. And, you know, President Bush obviously gave us a huge assist the organizing, and then of course we had President Obama, who was this unbelievably charismatic candidate, very well organized, very well disciplined, great message, especially aimed at this younger generation, which wants us to stop fighting about all the things we started fighting about in the 60s and start doing something about things like global warming. So there's a lot of factors that all came together, but the organization and the change in the direction of the Democratic Party, we started in, as soon as I got there.
Hi, welcome, Governor Dean. Mark Pettis, I'm a local physician educator. I'll be moderating the program.
Oh, great.
It's a real pleasure to have you here. I think we all recognize that the two big priorities are expanding coverage and controlling healthcare costs, and it will be impossible to make headway in the former without making significant inroads in the latter. And I'm wondering, where do you see the biggest opportunities to begin to reel in escalating healthcare costs? As you say, it's going up 2 to 3 times the rate of inflation each year, and as broadening coverage and introducing public plans will likely add expense, how are we going to manage those costs?
I'm not actually convinced that broadening coverage will add expense, because there are very few people who don't get health insurance, health care now. They just get health care, which is untimely and expensive. I mean, probably there's, I would guess in this particular area of the state, there's a lower rate of uninsurance than elsewhere. But if you went into many rural areas, or certainly inner city areas, there'd be a really high rate of uninsurance among working poor who are doing too well to be covered by Medicaid, but not well enough to have their own any kind of insurance. And those people get health care in the emergency room. So a strep throat may end up costing them $200, which it wouldn't cost if they went to your office. So, there are some savings there. Now, that's controversial in the end of the line. Do you really find savings in the long run? Maybe not, but certainly better health care. So leaving that argument aside, there are clearly two ways that you can save money. First of all is administration. The administrative costs of health insurance companies run around 30%. The administrative cost of Medicare is 4%. If it's a for-profit health insurance owned by shareholders, it's not unusual for the administrative cost, in other words, the percentage of your healthcare dollars that you pay to the insurance company, it's not unusual to have 50% of that not end up in the medical system. Between the shareholders, which you have a fiduciary responsibility to, if it's a publicly held company, and the salaries and the administrative costs that are so much greater than they are running Medicare. So just by having a public option, this is what the health insurance companies hate about the public option, they can't compete. Not because they're unwilling to compete, but because their overhead is simply inefficient relative to the public sector programs. They don't want to be inefficient. Well, I don't think there's a constitutional right to be an inefficient provider of health care, and therefore I think Obama's bill is the right bill for the American people. So that's one area where there'll be some savings. Some of that money that's now going into administration and shareholders' profits will be redirected into actually taking care of people. The other area, and then there's two other areas. One is the incredibly difficult area of reforming Americans' lifestyles. That is, if you were to have a real gatekeeper to the system, which you would have in a more government-oriented program, you would really be able to spend time with patients talking about lifestyles and doing some education. And there would also be some support workers, because the physician, frankly, is probably not the best person to do it, for two reasons. First of all, we don't get taught very much about how to do preventive stuff in medicine unless things have changed dramatically since I was in medical
not
school.
Much.
And secondly, we don't have the time, given how frequently we have to see patients and so forth. So physicians and extenders are going to do a lot of this, and that's a good thing. And that system could be rationalized in a system which understood, as some insurance companies do and employers do, but not a lot of them, that investing in preventive care will actually save substantial amounts of money. And the last piece is a global budget. The larger the system is and the more people are in a particular system, the more global budget is likely to work, especially if you have synchronization between primary, secondary, and tertiary care, which I think ultimately has to happen. But having a large public entity is part of that process. And as I said this afternoon to the high school kids, look, we're just going to exchange one set of problems for another here. We're not going to fix all the problems in healthcare. We're the only industrialized democracy that doesn't have a universal healthcare system that makes sense. But they all have problems too. It's just that I think most people who know a lot about this, including most doctors at this point, believe that their problems are in some less serious than our problems, both in terms of cost, in terms of delivery, and in terms of affordability.
Do you see the government, just as a quick follow-up, and
don't blow your whole questions here.
No, no, no.
Because we're going to want to talk about this in front of the larger audience.
But I'm surprisingly, I haven't heard much about the government renegotiating Medicare costs to drug companies for what they're currently paying.
Well, that was banned in the Republican version of the drug bill. That was banned. I think that probably won't be the case much longer.
We're going to have an article about hospitals.
But let me just say one thing about drug companies. I'm not big on making drug companies into villains because they have a, I mean, you know, you have to balance it and people have to be, you know, subjected to proper scrutiny and all that. But when you think about what drug companies do, some of the things they do are bad, like advertising pills that don't do any better than generics and cost three times as much and getting people to buy that stuff. That's ridiculous. And actually, when I was governor, I took some of that stuff off the formulary of the state because it was ridiculous. But a lot of what drug companies fundamentally do is keep people out of the hospital. 50 years ago, people went to the hospital for stuff that they don't have to go to the hospital. They live longer, and a lot of that's because of pharmaceuticals. So they really have improved quality of life. The other problem is this. Because of the system of drug regulation in the world, Americans pay for almost all the research and development costs of every drug, even though everybody in the world benefits from it. Now, that's not the drug company's fault. That's because we won't do anything about forcing other companies to pay their, other countries to pay their share, fair share of R&D. So this is a very, very complicated area, which I'm happy to say, I'm not going to take more time now, but we may have a lengthy discussion about this at the meeting tonight, because while I don't, you know, it's always fun to demonize this person and that company and that company, there are two sides to almost every story, and I think that the drug companies almost never get their good side told about it, and there is a good side to what drug companies do, and we should be fair about it.
We have time for one last question.
Okay, thank you. Hospitalists, I've never
yes.
heard the term. And all, I now know, Berkshire County hospitals have them. What are your feelings about them?
Very mixed. Mm-hmm. My wife is desperately trying to get hospitalists into the Burlington Hospital because it has become incredibly difficult for primary care providers to take care of their patients in hospital. That is because of the reimbursement system and the incredible downward pressure on what hospitals are willing to spend on residents. So hospitalists are really one of the only ways that you can preserve primary care practices. If I could go, I would gladly dial back 20 years ago when I was practicing medicine, not to need hospitals. For me, I love taking care of patients in the hospital because I get paid decently and I could set my schedule so I could get up and actually see them and take the time to do it. Today, a primary care provider can't do that because they don't get paid hardly anything at all. And their pressures on their office time are so enormous that they can't take the time to go. So hospitals are probably a necessary invention, but it probably doesn't contribute to the continuity of care. And again, a primary care provider can supervise the care with the help of specialists of even the most complicated, difficult patient in a teaching hospital with residents. But since residencies are being cut way back, specialists are sort of more siloed, it's become so difficult for primary care providers to take care of patients that I think hospitals are necessary. The problem is they shouldn't be necessary, and if the system worked the way it was supposed to and the way it did 20 or 25 years ago, they wouldn't be necessary, and it would be, frankly, better for the patient to have a doctor that they had known for 25 years coming in and participating in their care in the hospital instead of signing it off to somebody they'd never met before.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll now give you a couple minutes to prepare for your lecture. It was a pleasure having you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Can I get a picture with you and Aaron?
Sure.
Yes.